Good morning. Oh, good. Glad you guys are awake, because I'm not. My name is Greg Ruiz. I'm one of the evangelists from Adobe. And joining me in this presentation is Ms. Stephanie Sullivan. And I'll let you introduce yourself. Okay, I'll introduce her. She does not work for Adobe, contrary to what a lot of people seem to think. But Stephanie is an independent contractor, trainer, and CSS guru extraordinaire. And this session is called Responsible Web Design. And I sort of put featuring Dreamweaver CS3 because what we thought we'd do is take this from two perspectives. Number one, take it from the standardista's perspective of what should we all be doing, and then flip side it. And I'll talk about what we at Adobe are doing to help make these standards become possible and help it or easier, I should say, to implement through our software. So with that, sort of the question is, what is responsible web design? Of course, there's a couple of quick things. Of course, obviously, it means that we're staying up to date with the latest and greatest in terms of standards and best practices. It also, of course, means that we are approaching this in a way that is going to error-proof our designs, technologies as we move forward as well, so that if we build it right today, even as Internet Explorer 8 or 9 or 10 or whatever happens to come out, that we're still able to function properly. And of course, all that boils down to supporting these standards whenever and wherever possible. Now, obviously, we know that even the best laid plans sometimes go awry, and we do sometimes have to break the rules. In fact, we just wrote a book together that it's gone to the printer now, so you can pre-order it. In there, we even talked about the fact that, it's great to try to make these follow the rules all the time. There are times that, you just can't. So we do understand that, but we try whenever and wherever possible. I talked about going future-proofing our designs, but also responsible web design is backward compatibility as well, because, of course, we also know that, I know it's shocking for a group like us to think about, but there are people that don't upgrade their browsers. And that maybe even don't surf with JavaScript enabled. So, we have to think about those folks as well. And of course, it's also just a cool title for our session here. So, now what this is not is, of course, there are a couple of things, and that is, this is just a discussion. This is not, while we work in the industry and we think we know a lot, of course, we don't know everything. So this is basically just a discussion on, what are some of the best practices? What do we do? But of course, again, it's not an end all do all. And it's not going to apply in every single circumstance. I've very often in presentations been asked, so where's the bullet that, or the button I can click on in Dreamweaver that converts my entire table-based site to a standards compliant CSS-based design? There's not one, because of course, that's impossible, because we can't think of every situation that we might come into. And of course, this is just a starting point. This is not an end point. This is a work in progress as we move forward. Now, as we approach responsible web design, I sort of like to break it down into there are really three areas of focus. I sort of like to call it the trinity of web development. The first one, of course, is the HTML layer, the actual content layer, XHTML or HTML. This is where we start, and I'll let Stephanie expound upon this in just a moment. But this is the starting point. And of course, we realize that sometimes that is not just static content, it is content being fed via a dynamic data source called Fusion PHP or .NET or whatever. Then we have, of course, the CSS or the design layer. That again, Stephanie is going to go in more in depth on in just a moment. And finally, the JavaScript or behavior layer. And if we follow the principles of breaking our content, breaking our designs and our approaches into these three areas, and we focus on those, then we are going to be best served as we move forward. With that, I'm going to let Stephanie talk about standards and the supporting of standards.
Good morning. I got a question just yesterday eating at the hotel, and she was talking about somebody coming up to her and saying, well, you know, why do we want I don't buy standards. I don't really get this. And, you know, I don't know how many of you have been in web design for many, many years, but if you were or have been, you remember when there were no standards. And you remember when browsers created their own standards and their own features, and we had to know what each browser could do. And that period of time was extremely difficult. You had to code to the most used browser. If Netscape was ahead, okay, now we're all going to make things work in Netscape. We're going to all make things work in Internet Explorer. It increased our development time, and you got the great, this site best viewed in Internet Explorer at an 800 by 600 resolution, right? Now we have so many user agents, and browsers are moving towards standards, and the Web Standards Project, or WASP, has really worked hard to encourage, you know, beat them over the head and get browsers to actually move towards standards to make our life a little easier. But what are they? Well, the W3C develops the Web Standards and Guidelines, and WASP, the Web Standards Project, which is a grassroots coalition, actually, you know, helps to ensure that these standards are followed. I'm the co-lead of the Adobe Task Force at WASP. And so in that light, I've actually been able to work with Adobe. We used to be the Dreamweaver Task Force in getting them to move the products towards standards with every version so that it's simpler and easier for you guys to then follow those standards and not end up with big mass. So Greg already went over the fact that standards are basically the content or the HTML, the CSS or presentation layer, and the JavaScript behavior layer. When you work in this way, your upkeep time is very reduced. But of course, there's Flash when you're dealing with Adobe and when you're dealing with web development. How many of you use Flash? Decent amount. So Flash can contain content, presentation, and behavior. However, ActionScript 3 complies with the ECMA standards. It can be made accessible and should be made accessible, and I encourage any of you that actually use Flash to look into this and look at what it takes to make Flash accessible. It's built in and can be done, but many developers, especially younger ones with great eyes that don't think about the fact that accessibility is an issue for many people, don't really look at this. We're actually going to be trying to create some documents for you guys on the WASP site, because I believe that many Flash developers would tap into the accessibility features in Flash if they really realized how simple it was. And sometimes Flash is best combined with HTML and CSS. As I was traveling back from NAB last year, and I ended up sitting by the guy who was the MTV News web guy, and he was telling me how they were taking MTV's site out of being fully Flash and creating an HTML site with a lot of Flash pods or Flash areas. So Flash can be used very responsibly and very accessibly as well. And I'm going to quickly go through some advantages to businesses, because some of you may run your own business, some may work for larger corporations, and a lot of people don't realize the reasons for using these. But when you code to standards, and you hire people, you look for people that code to standards, you have a much lower induction into your company. They can hit the ground running. They already get what you're about. You have an ease of distributed development. A lot of people outsource or use third-party developers. When you use third-party developers that also code to standards, you can actually tweak their code and it doesn't blow up when you get it back. I do a lot of slicing and dicing and creating HTML and CSS from other people's design. But I also do a lot of cleanup, and sometimes people come to me with things they've outsourced to various countries and things like this, and they haven't looked for someone that codes to standards. And when they need to tweak the design, the entire thing falls apart. So this actually makes it a lot easier if you look for people that use standards. You have a predictability of the output. You can actually run it through the validator and troubleshoot and see what's going wrong because you know what it's supposed to be doing. You've got quality control. When your whole team is using it, it's very easy to find out what's going wrong. You've got an ease of reuse and conversion, and you can multi-channel distribute, which is very important these days. You can very easily convert it to other formats using XSLT. You can create PDFs. You can go into Word and Excel when you use well-marked up semantic content. And print and mobile, you can easily output to the various channels that you need to output. Accessibility, as I mentioned before, is a very important thing to think about. The aging baby boomers alone account for a large amount of money in the population, and their eyes are going downhill. And I can tell you about how that happens. Just wait till you're 40. You know, it happens. And so what happens is we're not thinking about the fact that many people aren't, that people need to increase the text size. If you use standards, your page doesn't break apart. If you use, you know, M-based design and things like this, the blind users a lot of times are what we're thinking of as well when we think of accessibility. And those people who have trouble getting out of the house, actually, if you have a standards compliant, accessible web store, they're a great market that people are not tapping into. That's how they can shop the easiest. You'll save money on modifications and development. Standards-based development with a well-versed developer is much faster, much less buggy, and later when you need to change something, your client wants the, you know, oh, my competitor has his stuff on the right, but I have on the left, and I think this is better. It's much easier to move things around site-wide. And lastly, search engine optimization, which obviously we all know that that's an extremely important thing for our clients. When there's less code soup, less markup, the little spiders, all they want is the yummy words. That's what they want, the content. And when the content is closer to the top of the page, they're going to pay more attention to that content. So standards-based design actually helps in a variety of ways. Now we're talking about, you know, what is a website really? A lot of people, when somebody comes to them and wants a website, first thing they think about is, I think blue and orange would be good for this, right? And this design, and I want it to look real shiny and web 2.0. Well, what is it really? A website is really your client's marketing content, their product information, the way they're going to sell. Everything about the site is basically content. That's what a website is. Now, how you present the content is the next step, but the development of the content is the most important thing for them. So, what happened? Oh, did it scare you when it fell? I was probably a sly, I don't know. Greg didn't change my transition, it jumped up. So you've got your client's content, right? So the first thing you need to do then is mark it up relating to its inherent meaning, and that's called semantic markup. I'm sure you read that on the web. You're reading someone's blog and they're talking about semantics. It's a very simple concept, really. It just means that a heading, something needs to be a heading. Don't put a CSS class on it. God knows you're not using font tags, but don't put a CSS class on it called green, bold, you know, 20 pixel. Mark it up as an H1 or an H2 or an H3, whatever it inherently is. This is also extremely important for search engines. Headings are. Search engines pay more attention to the headings on your page than they do to a piece of text that you've marked up to be green and big and look like a heading. They also pay attention to the titles of your page. Any text should be in P elements. Lists should be marked as lists. And of course, navigation is typically a list. Any item that can be a list, it's more accessible if you go ahead and semantically mark it up as a list. So it's just simply the logical meaning of the markup itself. Now, it's not really just about HTML because you can follow this logical thought through to your CSS. When you're creating your CSS IDs and classes, make sure that you don't name things right column, left column, you know, red text. No, because that can change. Your right column could end up later being your left column. That's just the beauty of CSS, is that you can move it around. So mark things up as column one and column two, or, you know, things like that. If it's going to be red text, because it's an alert, call it alert. Because later, you may not always be the person dealing with the CSS. When I mark up pages, I'm usually handing them off to a development team. They've got to understand what these classes and IDs are. And so naming properly is very important. Don't be afraid. Oh, why did we just leave? Okay, we left because I'm done with that. Now, let's look at this. This is actually content as given to me from when I was building my site ages ago. And basically the copywriter hands me this stuff and says, here's the content, right? So the first thing you do before, and this is really important, before you get into the design, you need to know what the content is. And then you wireframe it and design around it. I designed my, I had three different designers work on my own site a couple years ago when I was doing it. And that's because I got this idea. I wanted a CSS switcher, right? So I wanted these at least three cool designs so people could switch and see the power of CSS, that, you know, you can have this one HTML page and everything changes. So I got a woman, she did four different designs for me and they were beautiful. Except that when I had worked with the copywriter on my copy, there was no way to work my actual content into these very limiting designs that she had done. So though they were lovely, I had to dump them and do it the way I teach to do it instead of from, you know, the way we usually do it. And then I got my content like this, marked it up semantically. So you can see that here we have a quote and it is marked as a block quote. How many of you put block quotes on things because it makes a nice indentation in the page? That's not what they're for. Block quotes are not to indent. In fact, with CSS, you can make the block quote do anything you want it to do. I'm doing a session at University of Pennsylvania, and we're going to do some markovers and use their content and then show them how to redo it. And I was laughing because they had taken the entire content area of this one page and just put it in a block quote so that it would move in. So block quotes are for quotes. Then you'll notice the next thing I've got is a site, and that's the person that said this. I've got my navigation marked up as a unordered list. Then we've got headings with key elements. Now you'll notice these three headings are all the same. That's because they're equal. They're on an equal importance level. They're the three things I want to highlight. You don't have to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 on your headings. You can do it like an outline. You know, you've got 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. You know, it doesn't have to typically go in that order. I should probably have my dates marked up in microformats, which I probably will go back and do. But when I did this years ago, I wasn't thinking in microformats. So you see what I'm saying? This is all marked up semantically so that I can then put the divs or divisions of the page around, which is what you see here, and can then end up with a page where the content actually is moved around, shifted using CSS, and then ends up looking like I want it to look. Now, for many of you, perhaps you've struggled. If you started with tables, you may have struggled getting into the paradigm shift in your head for using CSS. I know when I first started, I was scared to death and wanted to glue everything down and make it absolutely positioned so I would be sure it didn't move and I wouldn't run into bugs. And that's not the best way to develop. But Adobe knew that people struggle with this, or people that know what they're doing may need a little quick start. So Adobe hired me, and I wrote 32 layouts that are included in Dreamweaver CS3. How many of you are already using Dreamweaver CS3? Okay, so there's a lot of you. How many of you use Dreamweaver, but you haven't upgraded? A few. So most of you that use Dreamweaver have upgraded. All right, so I'm going to show you this real quick. I don't know how many of you have actually looked at these, but they're accessed through the new dialog, which I should have done through File New. I'm a bad key command person. These layouts are accessed right here. You can still get to a blank page like you've always done, but we have all these different layouts. Now, Adobe and I looked at this and we said, basically on the web, what have you got? You've got one column, two column, or three columns, right? And you have a basic, you've either got a fixed width, which is the typical, I'd call it blog look, you know, usually centered in the middle of the page, except in the case of Adobe's new really terrible website, which is stuck to the left. I really hate it. Anyway, we're hoping they're going to fix it if we yell enough, but typically fixed pixel width sites are centered. People find them easier to use. I think because you know how wide your header is, it's easier to design and know that this is the width you have. However, it's not the most accessible way to design, but we've got, one, two, and three headers and footers. Let's look at one of these. Let's see. Let's go to the two column. I'll do elastic. Okay. So now what is elastic? Now you notice we've got a little icon up here in the corner. It has that funny little swirly thing. That's a spring. They had to tell me because I didn't know what it was, but that's a spring. And this, little thing here is obviously a lock and that tells you it's fixed, but the little spring tells you that this is something that is fluid or stretchy. We did a percentage based, which are the liquid, and that means that whatever the width of the browser, your design is going to react to that. So as you open and close, as your person is surfing with different size resolutions, different size browsers, you're actually going to fill up as much of that browser as you want to. This is, however, my favorite. This is the elastic. This one is based on M units, and this is a very accessible way to design. An M unit, for those that are not familiar, is based on the default font size of the browser. So most people are dealing with 16 pixels, most probably because that's what browsers ship with. Okay. That's when you download a browser, the base font size is 16 pixels. So one M unit then would be 16 pixels. But what if you have a really low vision user? What if they need their font at 32 pixels by default? They can go into their browser's preferences and change that. Most people don't, but people that need to do. When they do, then, for your site, 32 pixels will be the default 1M unit. And I'll show you the beauty of this very shortly, but the entire site scales based on that. So you've got various dot types you can add. It defaults to transitional XHTML. You can put your CSS in the head of the document. You can create a new file, or you can link to an existing file that you've already got. So let's create one really quickly. All right. So this is how they look. They're not beautiful. They're not meant to be beautiful. Those of you that have used Dreamweaver for a while may remember things like the Halo template. You know, you could go to this thing and it was already pretty, except that I've fixed that one so many times because it seems like developers get attracted to it because it looked nice and they didn't want to design. The minute you try to mess with it, it's really, really a touchy thing and it falls apart and then they hire me and they fix it. But this particular, these layouts are not meant to be pretty. They're meant to be very solid structures for you to start with. So we just put gray in so that you can see where the divisions are in the page. They work in all the browsers, all the current browsers back to Internet Explorer 5.5. They'll actually work in Internet Explorer Mac with just a slight bit of tweaking, but we didn't want to put hacks into these. We felt it was very important since we couldn't ship these with a PDF or something for you that you understand. So what we did instead was we did a large amount of commenting, which I think you can see there. So for each section in the CSS, I created comments that tell you how this works. So since this is M-based, it tells you how each of these elements may react when you change them. There are also inline comments for various property value pairs so that you understand when you change something and something doesn't look right, you can go up into the comments and see how it works.
I basically tell people that when you're getting started with this, take the time to actually switch into CodeView and read. Because once you've read through these, the beauty of what Stephanie did with all 32, 33 of the layouts, the beauty is that every one of them is structured the same way. So if you read the comments for one of them, pretty much you're going to understand the way that all the rest of them fit together as well. But do take the time to read, because there are some things, I think you're going to get into that, that otherwise might trip you up.
Yeah. And so, you know, everything is named, you know, semantically and named the same from layout to layout. You've got header, it's called header. You've got footer, it's called footer. You've got main content, sidebar one, sidebar two, and they're all named the same. Now, one of the really great reasons that we did this, you'll see right here, there is an odd little class name here. This is saying that this is a two-column elastic with a left sidebar and a header and footer. Now, the reason Adobe had me do this, and I really like this, I give them credit for this. This is so that you can combine pages. Many times you'll have a client where, you know, you've got maybe a three-column front page. They want to get a lot in there, but maybe when you get into the site, they only want two columns. Well, you don't want to keep your CSS in different pages. You want to put it all in one document. So with this class, which is placed on the body element, let me switch over here. I like split view. I like to play in the code a lot, but I like to see what I'm doing in the split view. All right. So here on the tag selector, you can see that I've got a class on my body or up in my code that says two column elastic left header. And each one is coded that way. Now, if I wanted to combine this with a three column, all I have to do is remove the class name right here on things like my container, my header, and my footer, because those are all common. I want every page to share that common element. However, for my sidebars and my main content, those would be different between a two column and a three column. And thus I would leave that on for those particular selectors. And then only the page with the body class on it for two column would read that part. And for the three column, it will read its portion of the descendant selector. So it gives you a lot of power to keep your CSS really succinct and organized. Now, I mentioned that we did not put any hacks in. What we did do, however, because we all know, yeah, okay, you saw where it was on the page. We do know that we have to deal with the browser called Internet Explorer, and that browser does not always play nice. So when you develop, always develop, you know, previewing in a browser using Firefox or Safari or Opera, something that is more standards compliant. I never even look at Internet Explorer till I'm all done. When I'm completely finished, I open up Internet Explorer and see what exploded. You know, I mean, that's what you got to do. But Internet Explorer, you know, we give Microsoft credit for giving us this little gift to fix the browser called Internet Explorer Conditional Comments. These are really powerful tools. If you're not using them, please go read about it. You can go to my site, W3 Conversions. I've got cards up here later. And I've got a resources page with links. I've got links so that you can go read about this. But basically what they do is you can target any version of Internet Explorer. You can target only 5. This one says if IE. So it looks rather, oh God, sorry, you can't see that when I highlight it. It looks rather like a comment, and other browsers don't see it. But Internet Explorer looks at this and says, if it's Internet Explorer, it will do this, you know, change these rules right here. Now, you can target if it's Internet Explorer 5, if it's Internet Explorer 7 and less, or 6 and greater. So there's a lot of different syntaxes you can use. Don't use hacks. You know, we saw what happened when we went from Internet Explorer 6 to Internet Explorer 7. And suddenly, you know, all the little hacks we were using didn't work the way they used to work. So it's really best practices to use Internet Explorer conditional comments in your pages. You know, it's been announced that Internet Explorer is basically being rewritten for IE8, which I don't know, I have any idea when they'll get it out, but it's supposed to be rendering super duper towards standards, more like Firefox. You know, I'll see, I haven't gotten the beta yet, but, if that happens and you've used conditional comments, it's going to make it much easier to tweak and fix if you need to do that, okay? So let's see. So we've got body class, the comments. Okay. Yeah, I'll show you this one in the browser because This is my favorite. Oh, I should do this. Okay. So this is an M-base, like I mentioned. Now you'll notice it basically looks like a fixed width, doesn't it? And when I change my browser, I can grab the corner. There we go. It doesn't react. Like the liquid would be getting larger and smaller. It doesn't react. But if I increase my text size, notice that the entire page increases in size. So the line length and the readability of your page remains really accessible for low vision users. I have an aunt that surfs the web larger than this because she has extremely low vision. Sometimes she ends up with like a word on a line. And let me tell you how hard it is to read like that. So when you create pages that are based on M-widths, it's an extremely accessible way by nature to design. My site is done that way, so you can play with that if you want to see how it works. And we wrote a chapter in the book based on M-widths and how to make a design fit in with that. I'm gonna let you do this from here because you're gonna move things in.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the other things we did was, first of all, I have to tell you, I love these starter layouts. I mean, you know, I know how to code CSS, but don't feel just because you're a professional and you know how to code CSS that don't feel that these things aren't going to be useful. I use them every single time.
I do too. I used to have snippets. You know, I'd make custom snippets and I had like 2-column snippet and 3-column snippets that I could quickly start. I literally go into these every time and start out.
Right. So they are, I mean, it is a huge, huge, huge time saver in getting started. Now, we also wanted to do some other things to just help us manage CSS. You know, one of the things is Dreamweaver has supported CSS since day one. If you remember back to Dreamweaver 1 or 2, if you've been around as long as I have, we've had support for CSS that whole time. But we've been gradually improving it and improving and improving it. One of the other things that I just want to mention is with the CS3 release, we really, really wanted to concentrate on rendering. So you're actually going to see in CSS or in your CSS-based layouts within Dreamweaver CS3, I'm not going to say we get it exactly like the browser because there are variances between the browsers. So we do a best guess at how it's going to be in a standards compliant browser, but we do a really, really good job. And so one of the things I'd encourage you, if you're not using Dreamweaver, if you are a hand coder and you live and die by code, and maybe you took a look at Dreamweaver in previous versions and said, nah, it's not for me, take another look because we've done a lot to really improve that. One of the other things that I want to show you right now is we talked a little bit about in terms of best practices and how to go about developing. You notice that when Stephanie created that page, she mentioned that you can put your CSS in the header, link to an external file, put it into an external file. Most of us would probably, you know, immediately think, oh, I'm putting it into an external file. Actually, I don't. I don't develop like that. Stephanie doesn't develop like that in a lot of situations. We actually develop with code in the head of the document. That way I know that I'm not screwing up the main style sheet for pages that are already working. So, and then I'm faced with that challenge of, okay, where do I go from here? Now, how do I get this out of the head? I got to move it and externalize it, which in the past has been a really, really painful process. One of the things I want to show you that we've improved upon, and this actually is my favorite feature in Dreamweaver CS3. I love this. One of the things that we did was we said, all right, well, let's say, for example, I'm done and I'm happy with these rules that I have. And by the way, for those that aren't using Dreamweaver, this is our CSS styles panel. It's divided into two views. One is called the all view. One is called the current view. I generally work in the current view all the time because that basically, as I click around, I'm seeing, you know, just the properties that are associated with that particular element. And the neat thing is that current view actually grabs all those properties from all the various style sheets and all the rules that affect it. So really gives me a great way to just really dial in on a specific issue that I may be having or want to change. So let's say that, you know, I've got it all working. Now it's in the head of the document. As I said, one of the great new features in Dreamweaver CS3 is the ability to just simply highlight some of these rules and just say, I want to move them. Now, when Dreamweaver says, okay, where do you want to move them to? as I said, if I've already got a style sheet that is external, that's got some of the rules that I've already fixed and stuff, I can actually point specifically to that style sheet. One of the really cool things is Dreamweaver will actually identify and merge the two together and tell you, ooh, you've already got a rule called body in that particular style sheet. How do you want to resolve this? Do you want me to override it, or do you want me just to append that to the style sheet? So really, really cool for that. I'm just going to do a new style sheet and just give that a real quick name, some styles, and just drop that in my CSS folder. And boom, what Dreamweaver has done is it actually has moved those styles out of the head of the document and relinked my page over to that style sheet. Now, that's pretty cool, but that's not my favorite feature. That is really helpful. This is my favorite feature, though. I left some of them by accident. So what do? Well, now that I've got them linked, I can just simply drag and drop. And as you can see, I can even reorder. And this is actually physically reordering the rules within the external style sheet. So really, really a cool way for managing. One of the other things that I wanted to show as well that happens a lot when we're testing, you know, one of the big challenges is bug busting with CSS. And one of the ways that both Stephanie and I like to bug bust is a lot of times in trying to just figure out, okay, why is, doggone it, I've got this rule and why is it not being applied? Or, you know, what's going on here? And usually what that is a matter of specificity, you know, that we've got some other rule that's more specific that's overriding and we're not finding that. Well, there's a couple of things that Dreamweaver helps us do here. Number one, for example, as I just hover over any particular rule, it's actually giving me a tooltip that tells me what the specificity is of that particular rule. So as I hover over this one, you can see it's changing. This one's 101. This one is 011. And so on. So that already is helping me figure that out. But even more importantly, what we do a lot is we'll actually go all the way down to using, an inline style.
Because we don't leave it there.
Yeah, we're not going to leave it there, but we use an inline style just to help us figure out, okay, doggone it. You know, I don't know where the margin is not getting applied or being overwritten. So I'm just going to go straight in. I'm just going to put it right on the element and see if that fixes whatever is going on. Of course, as we said, we don't want to leave it there. So one of the really cool, another really cool and unknown features of CS3 is here I've got this background color applied, and I'll just sort of show you that. That background color is applied right here as an inline style. So I don't want that to stay there. Let's say, you know, that did solve the problem. I figured out, yes, exactly, that's what I want, but I don't want it to stay there. So I can simply select in my CSS rules panel, simply select that inline style that I've got identified there and say, I would like to convert this to a real rule. And Dreamweaver will say, okay, as if I select it, convert it to a real rule. Dreamweaver will say, okay, how specific do you want to get? And it'll suggest a very, very specific level. And where do you want to put it? Do you want to put it in an existing style sheet? Do you want to put it in the head of your document or whatever? And so very easily, we can use those inline styles to help us bug bust and then convert that back out to real solid and external CSS. But no matter how good you are, And you know, it's always so funny to listen to someone like Stephanie fighting with a bug in a browser. She knows what she's doing, but no matter how much she knows, there's going to come a point where, oops, there's a bug there and you're fighting with it. You're going, you know, what is going on here? I can't figure it out. Well, there's another feature that Dreamweaver.
But you use bad words.
Yes, you use very bad words sometimes. So there is a feature that Dreamweaver has to help us there as well. And that is right up here, and that is called the browser compatibility check. Now, basically what we did was we went to folks like Stephanie and other luminaries within the CSS world, and we said, give us your bugs. What are the things that you run into most often? What do you bang your head against in terms of bugs most often? and we compiled these common bugs and gave Dreamweaver the ability to actually find them. So what Dreamweaver has just done in this particular page is it has actually looked through both the HTML, but more importantly, the CSS associated with the page itself. And in this particular case, I've run into, dun, 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 the doubled float margin bug, which apparently says when a margin is applied to a floated box on the same size of direction of the float, the margin is doubled. The bug only affects the first float in a row of one or more floats. I don't even know what that means. But I understand it must be something terrible. Yes, it's Internet Explorer. Imagine that. I know it's shocking. I'm glad you're sitting down. How likely is Internet Explorer to do this? Very. Okay, so crap. I realize that, you know, I've got to fix this. All right, and that then becomes the big issue. How do you fix it? All right. Well, obviously, for these kind of bugs, you know, I've had somebody come up to me recently at a presentation, go, why can't you just click a button and tell Dreamweaver to fix it? Well, because there's several different ways that you might go about fixing this. And, you know, and if we fix it in one way and you don't like it, you're going to yell at us for fixing it. Right. So what we did then was we said, all right, we're not going to be able to catch every bug. First of all, don't look at this feature and go, oh, it gave me a clean bill of health, therefore I have no bugs. Wrong. That's not what we said. We're trying to find the most common bugs. But we said, since we're not going to find them all, and there are some different solutions for each bug, what we're going to do is we've got this link right here. And when you have the bug selected and you click on this link, what happens is Dreamweaver will actually take you off to a section of our site called the CSS Advisor. Hey, Steph, look, I'm going to make this all nice and big, and watch how the layout still sticks over on the left-hand side of the window.
See? I hate it.
Even we don't like it. So, this is the CSS Advisor, and what this area of our site is, we had a goal with this, and we sort of said we want the CSS Advisor to be a one-stop shop for all of us in the community to help figure out where to get, you know, how to solve bugs. Now, you know, usually what I do is I run into a problem, I Google it, right? But the problem is then you get 37,000 different hits back on how to solve this, and you're bouncing around to a bunch of different sites. So we said, you know what, let's consolidate this. Let's bring all this information together in one place. And so that's what we did, once again, going to Stephanie and other luminaries out there in the industry. And so you can see, for example, for each of these bugs, you can see, for example, what the description of the problem is, what a solution is. But here's the coolest part. You'll also notice comments down here. We made this a wiki, so yes, you can contribute to this. Now, we moderate the contributions, but you can contribute to your solutions, or even, hey, you ran into a new bug. You don't see it listed on the site. Go ahead and file it. And give us your workaround and share that with the community. In this particular case, in the example that I had, this is simply saying, hey, you need to do display inline for your affected float. That would be great if only I knew which one of my floats was affected. So now how do I know? What Dreamweaver is telling me is on line 58 in your code if you're interested. But I don't even care about that. I'm just going to double click it. And Dreamweaver will actually highlight for you on the page exactly what it is that's going to break when that bug exhibits itself in the browser. So with that selected, all I need to do is, using the current view of the CSS panel, I run right over here and I say, okay, great. Let me just put in display inline. And boom, you'll notice sort of a blink. What happened there was Dreamweaver opened the external CSS file that was associated with this page, made the change for me. Now, if I rerun my check, I should get a clean bill of health. Once again, reiterating, we're not going to find every bug, but we're going to find the most common one. So at least I've got a great starting point. And combined with the fact that I started the layout using Stephanie's starter layouts, I'm already well on my way to knowing I probably got a pretty solid page at this junction, regardless of what browser I'm going to look at it. Okay, I'm going to switch gears, though, because we're talking about the Holy Trinity and the trinity of, we talked a little bit about content. Stephanie talked about content, the XHTML and semantic markup, and talked a little bit about CSS as that second piece of the trinity. The third piece of the trinity was JavaScript, and JavaScript for adding that behavior layer. So, you know, the thing about JavaScript is again, I've been around the web since I put my first page up on the web in the fall of 1994. So back then, you know, it was boring. And along came in the late 90s this thing called DHTML. You might remember that. Woo! All right. I don't know whatever happened to it, but you know, it was for a lot of us our first foray into JavaScripting. And of course, JavaScript has come a long way since those early days. In helping us build these sort of dynamic interfaces that are all the rage in Web 2.0 or whatever we're calling it these days, that whole move towards AJAX. Although I understand that, you know, AJAX used to stand for asynchronous JavaScript and XML, but apparently the guy that coined the phrase said it's not that anymore. It's just AJAX. I don't know what that means, but anyway.
It means you don't have to use XML.
Oh, is that okay? All right.
I think that's but, all of me.
So JavaScript is a big part of that. And what we're talking about, as I said, is not your father's DHTML. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about using JavaScript for a specific purpose, to build these cool interfaces, to build these progressive enhancements. But the problem is, when you're faced with implementing JavaScript into your site to do these types of interface enhancements, you're really faced with a choice. It's sort of the black box choice or the hand coding choice. Either A, I'm going to go out and I'm going to get a framework and I'm going to implement that framework as that black box. The problem is most of us don't know what's going on inside the box. Or again, you're going to hand code it. You're going to do it all yourself. Okay. I used to make a joke when AJAX stood for asynchronous JavaScript and the X. What's the X stand for? Expert. Because that's really, you know, what you're talking about having to be. If you're going to hand code something like that, you're really talking about that. So, you know, as we go about implementing now, I'm not going to suggest to you a right way or a wrong way, because whether or not you choose to go the black box route to implement a framework, or you choose to go a hand coding route, is really all, there's going to be considerations. It's going to depend upon the scope of the implementation, you know, size of the project and so on. So in sometimes even both is appropriate. Grab a black box, grab a framework, and then modify it yourself to fit your needs. That's sort of what we did with something called the SPRI framework for AJAX. And with the SPRI framework for AJAX, let me actually, before I go into this slide, sort of show you what we did in Dreamweaver CS3. Now, again, SPRI framework for AJAX is our own framework. We went about building it because, again, we looked at the market and looked at all the frameworks out there. And really, as I mentioned, all those frameworks really required you to be an expert. To really be able to get in and do anything, you had to be pretty much of an expert. So what we wanted to do was take a different approach. We call it a designer's approach to AJAX, but don't get me wrong. It doesn't mean that doesn't mean it's weak and it can't be modified, can't be very powerful. But we wanted to make it accessible for those of us who do not choose to go to bed at night dreaming of the dawn, right? So this is sort of the way it looks. Let me just sort of open up a page just to show you how you go about this. And I'll just one of the core tenets of SPRI was, again, we wanted to make this easy. So we built it with Dreamweaver CS3 the entire framework into the application. So one of the things you'll notice in Dreamweaver CS3 is we actually have a toolbar, a SPRI toolbar, and you can access the three core pillars of SPRI or the AJAX framework. Now, with SPRI, we have three pillars. That is the data. So where are we getting our data from? The interface elements or widgets, and then the effects that we can apply to them. These are JavaScript behaviors, things like animations, fading things in, you know, sliding things in, and things like that. But all of it can be done without having to write a line of code. I'll just give you just a brief example of what that might look like. For example, here I've got an area where I wanted an event listing to happen. Now, one of the things that we set out to do originally was, again, as I said, you know, support that X within AJAX, and that is XML. So in order to access XML within Dreamweaver, you just simply say, hey, Dreamweaver, I've got some XML here. And in my particular case, it's just a single file. This could be a fed from PHP, from ColdFusion, or any other data source. But for simplicity's sake, I'm just going to point it right here. Say, Dreamweaver, here it is. We all know that XML is our own made-up set of tags and languages. So we're going to tell Dreamweaver to go ahead and introspect that, get the schema to understand what tags are available to us. We're going to tell it which one of the tags in the document is the repeating tag. In other words, is the data entry. And we can do all sorts of things like introspect it and see, oh, these are strings, these are dates, these are numbers, or whatever. We could even have it automatically refresh this. So if you are building your own, for example, RSS reader, then it could automatically go out and get the new elements at a certain time and so on. But for my purposes here, I'm just going to say, okay, boom. At that point, I could begin simply dragging and dropping these placeholder elements onto the page. And when we upload the page, the dynamic data will suddenly appear via JavaScript and AJAX on the page. To make it, just to sort of really drive it home, I'm just going to delete this area right here and say, I'd like to format this nicely. One of our widgets is a data table. So I'm going to say, put me a data table on here. I'm actually not interested in all these columns. I'm only interested in a little bit. So boom, I've just sort of removed all of those and said, well, you know, if I've got a lot of event listings, maybe I want to be able to sort without, once again, having to reload and refresh the page. So by simply enabling the column to be clickable, now the visitor can actually click on the top of the column and the entire table will resort again without a reload. And everything that we do with AJAX is nothing more than just a combination of XHTML and CSS and a little bit of JavaScript. Therefore, for example, if I had gone to the trouble of creating some classes to style my table, I've got an odd row and an even row class that I've created, or maybe a hover class or a selected class or whatever, I can apply all these here once again without having to write any code whatsoever. Then most importantly, I can even identify elements on the page which are links, which have a connection with one another. So that if I click on this element, maybe an entry in this table, I want a different area of the page to update to reflect that data. Okay? All of this is done, again, without writing a single line of code. Now I'm just going to go ahead and show you a finished version of this. And I'll do this in the browser. So I'll show you what this looks like. So here I have the data table being fed in, the alternating rows, colors, the hovering. But when I click upon these elements, you'll notice that data is changing over here on the right-hand side. You'll notice also that the image is fading in and fading out. I have another interface widget here called the accordion pane. When I click upon that, we see little animations here so we can display a whole lot of data in a very limited space. Now, we were really proud of ourselves. We said, woohoo, Fry rocks. We released it out into the world. And boy, did we get beat up. Because all the standardistas out there ganged up on us and said, that's crap. Because of one little issue. Let me see if you can spot the issue. We remember that the J in AJAX stood for JavaScript. And as I said, as much as it shocks you and I to think somebody might surf without JavaScript enabled, you know, there are screen readers that don't have JavaScript. There are mobile handsets that don't support JavaScript. So what happens when you visit this page and JavaScript is turned off? Well, let's refresh and find out. There's a slight difference to the page. It's very minimal. Can you spot it? Okay. Of course, the problem being, we've got JavaScript that's being used to pull the XML in. So without JavaScript, oh crap, what do we do? All right, so the engineers actually went back to the drawing board. And if you go to labs.adobe.com, there is over on the right-hand side under the most popular links, the link over to the Spry framework or Ajax. We have a new release of the Spry framework. So we've actually broken the Spry team out. They are independent of Dreamweaver, of the Dreamweaver team. They're continuing to release updates. And they've released just now the 1.61 version of Spry. It includes an updater for Dreamweaver. So when you get it and download it, not only do you get the framework, you get an updater so Dreamweaver recognizes all this these newfound capabilities. Let me show you one of the coolest and best. And if you want to see more about how this is done, this just happens to be chapter 6 in our book. So there is one little problem here. I'm going to go ahead and pull this up. One of the other problems with the framework as it stood with the standard ISTAs is the problem that all of the dynamic stuff, let me go over here, all the dynamic stuff you see is identified for me in orange here, and it's part of the tags. So the standardistas really beat us up on this because, hey, you don't put illegal markup in your page. It won't validate. So what did we do? Well, here is, I'll show you this page. I'm just going to show it to you in the browser first. Okay. This is the page in the browser. We've got a new widget here. This is a sliding panel widget down here that allows us to just scroll through elements here. And as you see, you know, sort of, it's really fun. I could do this all day. This is so much fun. Like, woo! All right. Anyway, this is same implementation, but here's the key. Watch what happens when we turn off JavaScript. Okay, turning it off, boom, reloading the page, and it still looks okay. Doesn't have the other functionality. This is what we call the progressive enhancement. Okay, you come to my site, I designed it, and this is our approach. This is Stephanie and my approach. We designed the entire page as if we were not ever going to implement Ajax at all. Get it looking good. And now add the Ajaxian layer, the JavaScript layer on top to enhance. So the page looks good without without JavaScript turned on, but when JavaScript is turned on, you get that enhancement. Now, where did the data come from then? Because we were talking about XML, here's the last and the coolest bit. And I'm going to show that to you. Right now, I'll open this page up. Actually, I'll just show it to you in the obtrusive version here. Here's the coolest part of the 1.6. It's called an HTML data set. What we've done is we've told the Spry framework to look at the page we're on to find an element identified as gallery. And that is just a div that I've identified on the page. And to use that as the source of my data. Therefore, I can validate the page, I can turn JavaScript off. XML is no longer even playing into this in order to do what we're doing. And the best part about it is, then here, this page, if you look through it, you will find no orange whatsoever. Because the other great part is that the Spry framework 1.6 supports unobtrusive JavaScript, which means what I've done is I've moved every bit of that functionality out into an external JavaScript that is providing all the functionality. Okay? Which means I can run these pages through the W3C validator. They will come back with a clean bill of health. I can turn JavaScript off. My visitors still get access to the content. But when they come with it turned on, I can provide them with a greater and more enhanced experience. Okay. So with that, unfortunately, believe it or not, I'm going to just zip on through that. Blah, 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 blah. Come on. All right. And bang, 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 bang. I chose not to show you these boring slides. With that, we've unfortunately come to the end of our allotted time, I believe. Are there any questions real quick that you would just burning to ask? Yes, there's one right there.
Are you saying within Dreamweaver or using the validation in a browser?
Okay. So, the problem is obviously because of the include, Dreamweaver is not smart enough to understand that. Here's what I always do. And in fact, one of the things that I even do, for example, with my own blog, because it's done, it's WordPress blog is done with PHP and a bunch of different files. What I actually do is I go into Firefox and I use the web developer's toolkit or toolbar to say, show me the generated source. And then I copy and paste that into Dreamweaver, work it up, do all my CSS layouting and everything. And then I just use that as the temp file, if you will, to help me develop.
But if you're really just trying to figure out if your page validates, just use the web developer's toolbar and validate it with the W3C validator. That's what I do. I usually, validation is a really important thing that we didn't really touch on. It's not important to get a gold star or halo or, you don't get anything like that, but it's a great bug busting tool. It lets you know if there's a problem in your page. You can quickly find it. The first thing I do is validate, just to find it. So validation is important from a practical standpoint. There was another hand out here. Yeah.
Oh, mastering CSS with Dreamweaver CS3 from new writers.
Should be out in the first week of April.
And there are both of our blogs and Stephanie's website, my blog up there. We both got links on on there as well. So, and Stephanie's got cards. I'll put my cards out up here. Thank you guys for coming to the session. Thanks. Hope you enjoyed it.